For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It's November the 13th. We are in Shmuel Perek Test, Chapter 19. And we're going to be going backwards, but we're up to Pasuk... Yeah, we're up to Pasuk Girches, verse 18. But we haven't completed the discussion about the few psukim before that. The last thing we discussed was that David ran away, and he ran home after being attacked by Shaul. And then Shaul sent soldiers to wait to guard the house until morning, and then bring David to him to be killed. We talked about why he waited till morning, and then Michal tells David that you need to run away, otherwise you are going to be killed. So she lowers him by the window, and then she takes the terafim. This is what we haven't discussed yet. She takes the terafim. She takes these. We translated them as mannequins, but they are in the form of human beings. And she places them under the bed, under the covers, and she covers the top of it with, it says, kivir ha'izim, which is some sort of the hair of goats. And then when Shaul sent the agents in to take David, she said, he's sick. So the agents had to go back to Shaul, and Shaul said, bring him here in his bed. Then they went back to Michal, and then they discovered that it was a hoax, that he wasn't in there. It was the teraphim. It was these mannequins. So then Shaul challenges Michal, why did you do this to me? That you tricked me and you let my enemy get away? To which Michal responded that David said to me, send me away, why should I kill you? In other words, David threatened me, which is why I let him go. So that is where we were up to. What we did, we mentioned last time that we began the discussion of the teraphim, of these mannequins, statues. We drew the parallel between the same word teraphim is used by Rachel in this past week's parsha, Parshas Vayetze, when she takes away the teraphim of her father Lavan, and Rashi says she did it in order to separate him from Avodah Zarah, because he used to worship the teraphim, and he comes chasing after Yaakov and demands back his teraphim, his idols, and she sits on them on top of the. She puts them in the camel bag, and then she sits on the bag, and she deceives her father that she doesn't have them. So, one issue we were going to discuss is this teraphim that why would Michal have teraphim? Now, the first point we should make over here is that it would be difficult to suggest that these teraphim that Michal has are similar to the ones that Lavan had that Rachel took, for the simple reason that Rachel stuffs them in the camel bag and sits on them, and that keeps her father away. Her father doesn't know that she has them. Where Michal's teraphim are apparently big enough that they can they can be imposters for a human being. They could, right, say that as if a human being is under the covers. So even though it seems like there was more than one, because it says the plural teraphim, in plural, nevertheless, it would seem that whatever she had, whatever Michal had, was larger than what Lavan had that Rachel stole. Mm-hmm. So it would not seem that it's the exact same type of teraphim. Nevertheless, it is the same word, so obviously they're not just related, but they're very similar, but not exactly the same. So these teraphim, so we mentioned last time that they were mannequins. Obviously Michal didn't worship Avodah Zarah and David didn't worship Avodah Zarah. Just because Lavan used them for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, doesn't mean they are inherently Avodah Zarah. a person who worships idolatry could worship anything and turn it into an idolatry. They could worship the sun, the moon, the table, the light bulb, whatever they want to worship. So just because it's a form of a human being, it could be as innocuous as a mannequin, which is used to put clothes on, or to fit clothing when you're making clothing. In those days, not so long ago, in everybody's homes, clothing was made at home. It was rarely bought. And it may be that Michal had them to make clothing, although Michal was the princess. I don't know how much clothing she actually made herself. Whatever it is, but the fact is that it may not have any kind of a negative connotation at all. It could be there's just this form of a human being that was in the house, and she used them to use as a fake David. So that is possible. But the fact is, the same word being used is what raises our antenna. Like, why the same word to Rafim? Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Yisroel Kol Nivro. So, before we answer that question, or at least we show a suggestion to answer that question, I want to focus on another aspect of the deception, and that is the Kevir Ha'izim, which is this, Rashi says, or Mufshat, it's the hide that has been skinned whole from the goat. That's what Rashi says. So clearly this mannequin didn't look like a human being. It may have the shape of a human being, but it didn't look like a human being. So this would look like hair protruding from the covers. Deception in the Chumash. Deception. I was thinking through today, the very first deception in the Chumash. What is the very first deception in the Chumash?
Snake.
I would think the snake. Yes, the snake deceives Chava. He tricks Chava. I think that's the very first deception in the Chumash. After that, I'm talking about overt deception, not once through the Medrash, but where the Pesukim themselves describe a deception. I think before that, I think we have deception that Avraham deceives Paro. And he says, this is my wife. This is my sister. That's in Parshas Lech Lecha. In Parshas Vayera, again, we have Avraham deceiving Avimelech. Same thing. I was wondering in Parshas Vayera if we can even argue at the end of the parasha we have Hashem deceiving Avraham with Akedas Yitzchak in making Avraham think that he was to slaughter his son when that wasn't really the intention. So we have deception in the Torah. Perhaps some of it is good. Avraham deceiving Paro, I think, is good. And Avraham deceiving Avimelech is good. The Nachash deceiving Chava, that's no good. Hashem deceiving Avraham, I think that is good. So you have deception in the Chumash. When you get to Parshas Toldos, we have perhaps the most famous deception of the Torah, and that is Yaakov, where Rivka and Yaakov conspire and plot and succeed in deceiving Yitzchak. And we know that that was also good. It wasn't good that they needed to do it, but the fact that they did it was the right thing to do, and they deceived Yitzchak. Later on in the Chumash, there are several more deceptions that we have, but another fairly famous deception is the brothers deceive their father. After they sell Yosef, so they deceive their father into thinking that Yosef was killed. They take his kesones pasim, they take a special cloak, they dip it in blood, and they show it to the father, so the father will believe that he has been killed. And the Gemara itself makes the parallel that because Yehuda was the leader of the brothers, and he's the one who deceived his father, and he used the words, haker na, please recognize, or now recognize, is this your son's kesones or not? And Yaakov is then deceived. So in the same parsha, Yehuda is deceived by Tamar. Tamar deceives Yehuda, and there the Gemara draws attention to the fact that when Tamar becomes pregnant and Yehuda says therefore she must be killed because she obviously committed adultery, then the way that she serves notice to Yehuda that she was pregnant from him is she takes the items that he gave her as collateral and she sends them to him and she says, Ha Karna, recognize, please, do you know whose these are? So she doesn't want to embarrass him. That's where we learn that it's better to get thrown into a fire than it is to embarrass somebody. So she doesn't embarrass him, but she lets him admit himself. But she uses the same terminology, Ha Karna. So Chazal draw that parallel because Yehuda deceived his father, so he is deceived the same way with the same words. But all three of these deceptions also have another thing in common. The deception of Yaakov, when Rivka and Yaakov deceive Yitzchak, when Yehuda and the brothers deceive Yaakov, mm-hmm. and then when Tamar deceives Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
And that is?
To bring about Moshiach.
Okay, that's the purpose of it.
They all have permanent clothing.
They all have clothing, but even more than that.
The goat.
There's a goat.
The goat and the garment.
In all three, there's a goat. Mm-hmm. There's an ease. There's a goat. With Rivka, it says, the ace, how does it say over there? She takes the hide of the Gedi HaIzim, of the goat, and he'll be Shah al Savarav al Chakas Yadav. She puts it on his neck and on his arms so that he will appear to have hair, so he's more like his brother Esav. So she uses the goat skin to do it with the hair on it. That's what she uses. With the brothers, they slaughter a goat and they dip the kasones in the blood. Rashi over there says, because the blood of a goat is similar to the blood of a human being. It seems that of all the, I don't know if it's true, I don't know if it's exhaustive of all animals, but certainly of animals that were available to them, the goat's blood is the most similar to the human being's blood. And then finally, with Tamar, the way that he was deceived with the goat is that she took the collateral from him, which was his cloak and his stick and all that, and then the deal was that he would pay her with a goat. But then she said, I want a collateral. So she took the collateral. Then when he sent his friend with the goat, she wasn't there. So she kept the collateral. But that's what she used in the end to show Yehuda that he was the one by showing him the collateral. But the goat was the pretext that it was supposed to be for a goat and then it wasn't. So in all three we have a goat. The last two, second and third one, are obviously they are bringing about Mashiach, the sale of Yosef and then Yehuda with Tamar. But even Yaakov and Esav, what is happening over there with Yaakov and Esav? Yaakov is purchasing, or actually he already purchased, but now he is getting the brachos as the bechor, as the firstborn. He's getting that birthright, which he had already bought, but now he was becoming his and solidly. That birthright is the thing that makes Yaakov the main, the focal point of history. And as we've said many times in this class and other classes, the real focal point of history within Yaakov is, which is Klal Yisrael, is the focal point of history, but within that, the Jewish people, the main line of the Jewish people is that of Yehuda, of David, of Mashiach. That's the main one. That's the one that the thread of history revolves around and is intimately connected to this line of Malchus based David, which ultimately is Mashiach. We're waiting for Mashiach. Of course, that means we're waiting for the revelation of Hashem, we're waiting for the Beis HaMikdash, we're waiting for all kinds of things. But we say we're waiting for Mashiach, because Mashiach is the trigger for everything else. That's the main line of history. Yaakov getting the Bechorah, the birthright from Esav, is solidifying the fact that Yisrael, that the Jews are the main focus of history. And within the Jews, it is Yehuda. But moreover, the rivalry between Yosef and Yehuda reflects the rivalry between Leah and Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
Yosef coming from Rachel, Yehuda coming from Leah. When I say rivalry, I use the term, I'm almost borrowing the term, because Rachel and Leah spent so much time deliberately focusing on not having a rivalry. That was their whole avodah, that was their whole service of Hashem. But nevertheless, there is a certain separation between the tribes, and it is a reflection of this Rachel and Leah, that there are two parts to the Jewish people. We know that initially those two parts were meant to be not all of the Jewish people, but rather a main part and a secondary part. The main part being Yaakov with Rachel, and the secondary part being Esav with Leah. As the Nevuah, as the prophecy was, V'rav Ya'avod Sa'ir, the older one will serve the younger one. That Esav, had he been a tzaddik, would have married Leah, and together they would have become the, not the center stage, which is Yaakov and Rachel, but the secondary, the one that promotes the center stage of Yaakov. When Esav falls down on the job, but Leah does not fall down on the job, she is still a tzaddikess, she lived up to her potential, he didn't. So then, the whole process of Yaakov purchasing the Bechora from Esav and then getting the brachos from his father and then marrying Leah is the gradual process of Yaakov taking over both jobs. Mm-hmm. Where it's no longer Yaakov and then Esav being a supporting role, but rather Yaakov has both jobs as manifest with both wives of Rachel and Leah. So the first deception that we're talking about is the deception which put Yaakov in both roles. But both roles created a certain friction, because there are two roles going on at the same time within the Jewish people. And that is the role of Rachel and the role of Leah. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that had Esav married Leah, that then royalty would have come from Esav. I don't believe that's true. I think then royalty would have come from Yosef. Because ultimately, that's what was supposed to happen. And Yosef would have been, he would have had everything come from him. He would have been the Bechor, he would have had the royalty, he would have had the Kahuna, it all would have come from Yosef. That didn't happen because of this switch. But there is still a role that Esav could have played that he's not, that is now being played by Leah. And her children, therefore, represent a certain strength, while Rachel's children represent a different strength. And there's a little bit of friction there. It's difficult to work it out. When the brothers sell Yosef and they deceive their father, that is that friction coming to a head. That's the worst point in the friction between the brothers, is when they actually sell Yosef. After that, it's all repair. After that, there's a constant attempt to repair the relationship for the rest of Sefer Bereishis, all the way to the end of Vayechi. When a result of that is that Yehuda is now diminished in his stature from the brothers, and he ends up with this whole thing with the daughter of Shua, and then having children, and then taking Tamar, and his children die, and then the whole thing with Tamar, that is Yehuda redeeming himself when he admits to the sin with Tamar. It's not really a sin, but he admits to what he did. So that is the beginning of the redemption of Yehuda for having sold Yosef. It is from there that he's able to move on and actually face Yosef and then accept the admonishment of Ani Yosef Ha'od Avichai, I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? You weren't worried about our father when you sold me. Why are you worried now when Binyamin is going to be sold? That was brought, the reason why Yehuda was prepared to accept that slap in the face was because he had already reached a point where he can accept admonishment, where he can take criticism. The hardest thing for a human being to do is to take criticism properly. And Yehuda reaches that pinnacle where he can say, I accept it. Which is why David HaMelech, who comes from Yehuda, is also the paradigm of that. Later on, when we get to Bathsheba, and David HaMelech is accused, and he realizes his sin, he doesn't deny. He says, Chatasi, I sinned. He says it right away. In contrast to Shaul, who has a hard time getting to that point of Chatasi, I sinned, with Amalek. With David, it's going to be an immediate Chatasi. He accepts it. That is the hallmark of Yehuda. That begins with Tamar. So the goat finds its way into each of these deceptions, which are all the thread of Mashiach. Here, the Michal, who is trying to preserve that line which hasn't even started yet, that fledgling line of David HaMelech, who her father wants to destroy, she saves the line through, again, a goat. Yeah.
With Shlomo, though, he doesn't readily accept that he sins. When he has too many wives, he gets horses from Egypt, he seems to do a lot of things that Hashem tells him not to do. I never remember him saying...
We don't have the same type of example of a Navi coming to him and saying, this is what you did. See...
Do you have to admit that you sinned?
You have the contrast of Shaul and David. In both cases, the Navi said to him, you did wrong. Shaul's reaction was, no, I didn't. And then Shmuel had to say it again. And then Shaul says, I sinned. But there was that initial, no, I didn't. With David, when the Navi comes to him and says, you sinned, he says, Chatasi. Right. That's the contrast that we have. So it's true, people do things wrong. And you're right, Shlomo does do some things wrong, again, on his level, but he does do some things wrong. But the contrast of being told directly, you did wrong, and to be able to immediately absorb that and say, Chatasi.
But also, when Natan came to him, he said, he gave him the story about, you know, someone who only has one and, you know, whatever. Where, when it was given over to, you know, he said, you know, did you do what God told you to? He didn't give a story. He didn't put it in a term for him to understand. But after that, when he said, what's that bleeding I hear? Like, come on, you know, what's going on? Then he hopped it. So
he denies it a second time with Shaul also. When
yeah,
he says
but,
he missed
I mean,
it.
Maybe the prophet isn't reaching them on the way they
can
understand.
So we have to wait till we get to David and go through that carefully. We do have to assume that the Navi gave it over as best as he could think to do. I mean, that's what we have to assume. But let's wait until we get to David and Bathsheba before we go through that carefully. So, yes.
I would just like to say that I think there are a lot more parallels between what Michal does and what Rachel does. Michal and Rachel are both younger daughters that are saving their husbands from their fathers.
Very good.
I mean, it's amazingly parallel.
Right. Very, very good. Very good.
So beyond just the teraphim. And then I have a question about the word teraphim.
Yeah.
Where does this come from? And is this related to the verb to pluck? Like when the dove, you know, plucks the teraph?
That's with a tess.
Okay. So we're... What is it? You know, what does this mean, this word?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, the translation is Salmanaya, which means statues or forms of a human being.
Is this shore seen elsewhere? Is it a recognizable shore?
I'm not sure.
Thanks.
With Michal saving David, it should be emphasized also, just because I don't want to forget to say it, that here again we have a manifestation of what we talked about, where with Yonasan and David, that at the end of the day, today, when we look back and we say we have a line of David HaMelech, Baruch Hashem, we're waiting for Mashiach, that line wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Michal.
Mm-hmm.
Michal saved David's life. We're going to find that Yonasan is going to save David's life as well. So that although Shaul is trying to kill David, ultimately his children are why David still exists.
Mm-hmm.
So we still can go back and give credit to the line of Shaul for the fact that David is still here, even though Shaul himself is the reason why he almost wasn't here. But still, it is within the family of Shaul that David's line is preserved. That's an important point, which is what we were trying to say, that was ultimately the hope, that even though Shaul's going to lose the kingdom, but perhaps through this intense relationship between his children and David, one as a best friend, one as a wife, that there can still be the influence of Shaul within David, and therefore Shaul is not completely lost. So even though in the end Shaul is completely lost, Shaul is killed, Yonatan's going to be killed, Michal's not going to have children, we're going to have all of that, all the loss of Shaul's family, but even today the legacy still exists because it is through Michal and Yonatan that David is alive and then can continue. What about the Teruvim? What about these figures of a human being? So I want to call your attention to another reference to Teruvim, although the word Teruvim is not used, and it's later on in Shmuel. It's actually in Shmuel Beis. Okay, let's move briefly to there.
You're saying Teruvim means not used?
No, the word Teruvim is not going to be used. I'm going to show you a reference, but not with the word Teruvim. Let's go to Shmuel Beis. It's in Perek Hay, chapter 5. And it's in Pasuk Yud, verse 10. We are not going to develop this fully. We're going to save this when we get there. There's a lot to talk about in this episode. But this is the episode of conquering Yerushalayim. When the Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim was a difficult place to take control of. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And they had trouble. So here it says, Vayelech HaMelech Va'anashav Yerushalayim, the king and his men, meaning David and his men, came to Yerushalayim, El HaYevusi Yoshev Ha'aretz, to the Yevusi, that was the nation that was dwelling in the land. Vayomer LeDavid Lemer, it was said to David saying, Lo Savo Heino, you may not come here. Kim HaSircha HaIvrim VaPischim Lemer, until you remove the blind ones and the lame ones, saying, Lo Yavo David Heina, David will not come here. So there's something about blind ones and lame ones that are keeping David away from Yerushalayim. And then it says, Vayilko David es mitzudas Tzion, David, he conquers the city of David. And then the next, then it says, let's just read the next verse, even though we're not going to explain it fully. Vayomer David, Vayomer, who David said on that day, Komake Yevusi, anybody who strikes the Yevusi, that's that nation, V'yiga batzinor, and touches the tzinor,
the stronghold.
It says here, aqueduct.
Yeah, well, it means the tower or whatever it is. V'es ha-pischim es ha-ivrim, and the lame ones and the blind ones, Sone Nefesh David, who hate the soul of David. Al Kain Yomru, therefore they say, Iveru Fiseach Layavo El Habayis, the blind one and the lame one will not come to the house. Okay. It doesn't say what happens if you strike the Yevusi and touch the tower and the blind ones and the lame ones. It doesn't say what happens over there. In the end, Yoav ben Tseruya is the one who does it, and that leads to a whole, that Yoav becomes the general of David, and that's a whole discussion which we'll have then. So there is this reference to the blind ones and the lame ones. The simple meaning is it's talking about some people who are blind and lame. However, Rashi tells us as follows. I will read the Rashi. The people of Yevusi were of the descendants of Avimelech. They came from Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim. V'hayu lahem shnei tzelamim. And they had two figures, two statues, two tzelamim, which is tzelem is the Aramaic for teruvim. They had these two tzelamim. Echad iver v'echad piseach. One was blind and one was lame. Meaning that one was shaped as a blind person, was meant to look like a blind person, and one was meant to look like a lame person. Shenasu al shem Yitzchak v'Yaakov, which were meant to represent Yitzchak, who became blind at the end of his life. Why was that significant that he was blind?
Because he couldn't see.
He couldn't see Yaakov and Esav, so that he could be deceived and the brachas could be taken. And the lame one refers to Yaakov, who in this coming week's parsha
wrestles with the angel,
becomes lame. That's the Gid Hanasha. That's Yaakov. So there's a reference to the blind one and the lame one, these two Salamim, these two Terafim. Uvepiyam Hashvu, and in their mouths was the oath Shenishba Avram Avimelech, that Avram had sworn to Avimelech that we will not attack the Plishtim, that we made a bris, we made a covenant with Avimelech. Ulekach lo horisham kishalachdu Yerushalayim. That's the reason why when we originally conquered Yerushalayim, we were unable to conquer the Yebusi. Not because we weren't powerful enough, Yehoshua was powerful enough, but because of the oath between Avraham and Avimelech. Therefore, lo lachdu et ha-metsuda, kimo shenemar et ha-yebusi Yehoshua Yerushalayim, etc. So there was a problem in conquering these people because they were from Avimelech, and there was a covenant between Avimelech and Avraham. The statute of limitations, the length of time of that covenant, ended at this time with David. And now it was already possible to attack the Yebusi because they weren't giving up. And so David says to get rid of those statues that represent Yitzchak and Yaakov. So we find in the same word that Terafim are Tzalamim, that's the Aramaic for it, are also in these Ivrim and Pistrim, these blind and lame idols. They're not idols that were worshipped. They're not Avodah Zarah. They were meant to represent Yitzchak and Yaakov, as if to say, we, the Plishtim, are immune, are protected from the influences of Yitzchak and Yaakov. You Jews have to stay away. You can't attack us, you can't influence us, you can't do anything to us. We are off limits from your influence. And then David has to have those terafim destroyed in order to show that the time of that Shavu, the oath, is done and now we're able to attack. So again, we'll discuss all the details of that when we get to that story. But we find, therefore, another set of terafim. These are owned by the Plishtim, but they're not Avodah Zarah. They're not idolatry. They are something else that are meant to represent something. So that we don't need to be stuck with the Terafim being necessarily idols. They can be worshipped. They were worshipped in the time of Lavan. His Terafim he worshipped. But they don't have to be worshipped. I was asked many times in this week over Shabbos, why did Rachel still have those terafim when she ran away from Lavan? Why did she keep them? She took them away from him, so why didn't she, when she passed the river, throw them in the river? Why did she hold on to them until Lavan caught up? She had them for 6 days before Lavan caught up. So get rid of them. Why is she bringing them back with her? It would seem to indicate, although I don't know for certain, but it seemed to indicate that these terafim didn't have to be Avodah Zarah. Even though there is a technical halachic issue with once something is worshipped by a non-Jew, then it becomes prohibited to get any benefit from it. And we Jews can't remove its status as an idol. Only the non-Jews can remove the status. In other words, a non-Jew who decides to worship the holy bottle of water and then decides that holy bottle of water has treated me badly, therefore I'm not going to worship anymore, so they take it and they throw it away, then they have removed its status as a worshipped item. But we can't remove the status of the worshipped item that they worshipped. So if Lavan actually worshipped it and now Rachel is taking it with her, it would seem to be halakhically impossible for her to get any benefit from these terafim if they are an idol. So the question really is pretty strong. Why didn't she get rid of them?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question. But terafim are not inherently Avodah Zarah. That's the point I'm trying to make to you. And therefore, the fact that Michal has terafim, it's not. We don't have to assume that these terafim are idols. And we do find that the terafim could be representative of something else. And that is what we find later on, that they're representative of Yitzchak and Yaakov. Why would Michal have terafim? What would she want to have a representation of in her house? What could that be that she would have a representation of in her own home? What does she use the teraphim for?
To deceive her father.
It's true, but to represent?
A person.
Which human person?
David.
David. It is possible that her teraphim were a representation of her own husband that she had. You know, we have pictures that we put up on the wall.
That's an interesting thought.
They don't have pictures.
Right.
Now, they could have paintings. They could also have sculptures. So, she would not have had an exact likeness of a human being, because then you get into questions of whether you're allowed to make such a thing. There is an issue about having an exact likeness of a human being. There is a question of whether one's allowed to do that. And not even if they don't worship it, but to make a statue with an exact likeness of a human being, there are questions about it in halacha. Some are more stringent, some are more lenient. Those who are very stringent are the ones who will only if they buy a doll for their child, they'll cut off the nose or something like that to make it not look exactly like a human being, right? Others are more lenient, so you don't have to do that with a doll because anyway, it doesn't look exactly like a human being. But there is this idea of not having, so it would not have been an exact likeness, but it seems that Michal had teraphim in her house, which resembled her husband David. I'm suggesting to you that it wasn't just by mistake that it resembled her husband David, but it actually was meant to resemble her husband David. That was the purpose of the teraphim. Whether it was for sentimental purposes, whether it was when her husband was out at war and she wanted to remember her husband, whatever it is. Or maybe it was in order to fit his clothing, when making, whatever it is, but it was meant to be a representation of David or her husband.
If it was in singular, I would buy it. But because it's in plural, I have a hard time with it.
How many pictures of your husband do you have?
If I had a likeness of him, I'm going to pick the likeness of him that I like the most. And the only picture that we have up on our wall is our wedding.
I don't
have other pictures of him up there.
You're mentioning a good point. I just don't know if it was one piece. It could be that they were various pieces that had to be put together to make the likeness.
If I have it there to remind me of my husband, I'm going to have something more solid than something I have to put together. That still doesn't, not let's put together the puzzle, kids. So let's see what daddy looks like,
I would offer to you that in Hebrew, some words are grammatically plural that
yes,
we think
that is
of
true.
As one. So you can think of many of them, I'm sure. Mayim, Shemayim, Chayim, there's lots of them. So we our concepts for those words are always singular. And so I would not put it past the fact that teraphim, although it's grammatically plural, might refer to a singular concept.
And as I mentioned, I think last time, the translation in my book says took it.
Yeah, right. Well, that's
them.
Yeah, but it could be the translation is because she put it in the bed as a likeness to David, so they're just assuming it's it. Right? But it's a good... yeah, it does switch to the singular in the middle of the verse. In Yud Gimel, in 13, it does switch in the middle when it says she put it at its head.
Yeah, that's the verse I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, be that as it may, I'm not sure. It is still a mystery to me exactly what they are, but it's possible this is what it is. Yes?
My question is, how do we know that the covenant ended with David?
For that, you're going to have to wait till we get to it in Shmuel Beis. That's what I didn't want to move into right now.
Oh.
You're right. We're going to have to deal with that when we get there, because it's a very long time. It's many hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we have to deal with that when we get to it.
Many hundreds of years
till
we get there.
Yep. No. Come on.
I have one more question about teraphim. If teraphim are forms that are nevertheless not a Vodazara, has anyone ever drawn a comparison with the egg, with the golden calf, which was a form, but we're told that the Jewish people did not worship it as a Vodazara. It was in a different class. It was supposed to be reminiscent of
I mean, they definitely bordered on worshiping it. When we say they didn't worship, what we mean to say is they didn't actually make it into a deity, but they definitely were
pretty close.
Yeah, they were pretty close, and then they were punished as if they served Avodah Zarah. That is the level they were on. So now he runs away. She says that he threatened to kill me, which is easily understood why she would do that. She's not going to stand up to her father. Yonasan, we will see later, will stand up to his father. When Shaul says that we have to kill David, Yonasan says, what'd he do? Why do you have to kill him? Like, Yonasan is willing to stand up to his father. But we're not going to blame Michal for not standing up in that way to her father. I would imagine that she did not have the same standing as her brothers, Yonasan. Yonasan is the heir to the throne. Yonasan clearly is himself a warrior and himself respected by the people as a leader. So we can understand the prince, the heir to the throne, is going to stand up to his father when necessary. To expect Michal to stand up to her father when he's accusing her of having saved his enemy, it makes a lot of sense that she would give the easiest and most plausible excuse, which is that he threatened me, so I had to let him go. We'll see later that will result in one of the most fascinating stories about an individual who is not so well known. We'll see later on. So we're up to Pasuk Yeches, verse 18.
Is that considered a deception, another deception?
Well, say what?
Is that considered another deception?
Yeah, for sure. She's deceiving her father one more time. Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, this is already one lie creates another one. You know, she's got a... Pasuk Yeches, verse 18. So David barach, David ran away. He escaped. Vayimolet, and he ran. Vayavo el Shmuel haramasa. And he came to Shmuel in Ramas. So now he has to run. Where is David going to go? This is the first time that he's running away. He ran away from Shaul and ran home, but Shaul sent people home to get David. Evidently, David thought he was safe at home. Remember, we're dealing here with Shaul, who is going in and out of this ruach ra'ah, of this evil spirit. When he's under the influence of the evil spirit, he is out to kill David. David now realizes that it's dangerous. He runs home. But when he runs home, so he thinks he's going to be safe at home because perhaps Shaul will come to his senses and that'll be that. But Shaul sends agents to kill him. So David recognizes now it's not so simple. Now where does he go? What should he do? He's dealing with the king. The king, the long arm of the law, the royal arm of the law goes across the entire country. Where exactly is David going to go? So from here until the end of Shmuel Aleph, we are going to find that David is constantly trying to figure out where should he go to get away from Shaul. So his first attempt was home, where Shaul's own daughter is his wife. He figures, I'm safe there. No, he's not. The next place he runs to is the next most likely person that will give him, I guess we'll call it amnesty. And that will be Shmuel, who in all of the Jewish people is respected by everybody. His first attempt is to run home to Michal, assuming that Shaul wouldn't want to do anything with his daughter, but that doesn't work. So the next place to go is go above Shaul's head. Go to Shmuel, where Shaul would never want to compromise Shmuel, the great Shmuel. So he runs to Shmuel in Ramas. Vayaged lo eskol asher asa lo Shaul, and he tells Shmuel everything Shaul did to him, all that's going on. So he explains it. Vayelechu Shmuel, vayeshvu b'Noyos. And he and Shmuel went, and they sat in, or they dwelled in, Noyos. Okay, let's for the time being presume that Noyos is a place either right next to or within Ramas.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see later exactly what this is. Vayugad l'shol lemar, was told to Shaul, saying, Hine David b'Noyos b'Rama. David is in Noyos in Rama. Vayishlach Shaul malachim l'kachas es David. Shaul sent agents to take David. So even there, Shaul is not willing to say, well, Shmuel is with David, I'm not going to take him from there. I mean, I wouldn't embarrass myself in front of Shmuel. No, he sends agents. Fayar es lahakas hanevi'im nibi'im, and they saw this, these agents saw this group of prophets who were prophesying. Ushmur omei nitzav alayim, and Shmur was standing on them. Vatihia malachei shol ruach elokim, and it was on the agents of shol, the ruach, the spirit of Hashem. Vayisnabu gam hema, they also started to prophesy. So they came, they're coming, these armed guards are coming to take away David. They get to the area where he is, and there is Shmuel standing with a group of Nevi'im, of prophets, and they're all prophesying. And these agents, they see this, they're taken with the sight, and they are drawn into the spirituality of the whole thing, and they start to prophesy. So forget it, they're not taking David now. Chafal 21, Vayagidu l'shol, and it was told to Shoal that that's what happened. Vayishnach malachim acherim, so he says, okay, I'll send the second group of agents. Vayishnach bugam hema, and they also got there and began to prophesy, so they also left David alone. Vayosef shol, Vayishnach malachim shalishim, so he sends a third set of angel of agents. Vayishnach bugam hema, and they also began to prophesy. So he sent three groups of agents, his SWAT teams, the best in the business. And now they are all under Shmuel's sway. They're all in a state of nevuah, of prophecy, enjoying this connection with HaKadosh Baruch, with Hashem, and they're not now going to take David. So what is Shaul going to do? Vayelech gam hu haramasa. So now an astonishing thing happens. He, Shaul, himself goes to Rama. Says, okay, if you can't get someone to do it right, I'll do it myself. And he goes to Rama. Vayavo ad bor hagadol, he comes to the large pit, which means a pit of water. There's a water hole. He comes there. Asher basechu, which is in a place called Sechu. If you're wondering, what is this place called Sechu? That is a very good question. We will discuss that, please God. Vayishal vayomer, and he asked and he said, Eifo Shmuel v'David, where are Shmuel and David? So here you can imagine that he's absolutely beside himself. All these people are coming and they're failing. He says, forget it, I'll do it myself. And he marches up to this place and he goes, where's Shmuel and David? Now, the difficulty here is that, what do you mean, where's Shmuel and David? He knew full well where Shmuel and David were. He was told that they were in Naios in Ramah. And he sent agents there. So it's a funny thing that he's asking where they are. And they answer by Omer, Hine ben Naios Barama. You know where he is? He's in Naios and Rama. Well, we already said that several times. And he sent agents there. So it's strange that Shaul's asking where they are. Vayelech Sham el Naios Barama. So he went there to Naios Barama. Vatehi alav gam hu ruach Elokim. And he also gets the spirit of Hashem. What is Shaul missing, lacking, desperately wishes he had back? Ever since he did the sin with Amalek, the Ruach Elokim. Here Shaul gets it back, the Spirit of Hashem. And he went and he was going and prophesying ad bo ben Ayas Barama until he got to Ayas Barama. So there he's prophesying along with everybody else. Vayivshat gam hu begadav, and he also removed his clothing. The Mefarshim say, the commentaries say, means his royal clothing. In other words, he made himself look like anybody else. And he also prophesied in front of Shmuel. And he fell. Arom means without clothing. And again, as the commentaries explain, it means without the outer trappings of this world. He became completely and totally enmeshed, engrossed in spirituality that entire day and that entire night. Al Kain Yomu, therefore they say, Hagam Shaul Banavim is also Shaul amongst the prophets. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We had that before.
Mm-hmm.
Where did we have that before?
Back when he first was anointed by
Shmuel. Back when he first started to become king.
Yeah.
When he first became king, Shmuel told him, you will go. And what's going to happen? That's true. And then you're going to go on and you're going to meet?
Prophets.
A group of prophets.
Right.
And you will begin to prophesy with them.
Yeah.
And then you'll know what to do. And that's what happened. And he went, he became a prophet amongst them. And people said, Hagam Shaul Banavim, Shaul is also a prophet.
Right.
The exact same story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's very
same
similar. Same words. The parallels are inescapable. that here Shaul goes through the same process as when he became king. The only problem is that Shaul lost the kingship. And here, he goes through the process that he went through when he became king. Now, it's a good question. And that is the end of this episode.
Yeah.
And I want to just make sure you understand, if you look at the next two words, Vayivrach David.
Yes.
David runs away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like last time that David and Shaul had a resolution in the field when Yonatan speaks to Shaul and he gets Shaul to snap out of his evil spirit, and then Shaul wants to be friendly with David again, and it's like Kismol Shaul Shalom. It's like yesterday before. It goes back to normal, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And David goes back to playing the instrument in front of Shaul. Everything goes back to normal until Shaul again gets taken over by this Ruacha. Here, David runs away. He doesn't hang around. Even though, clearly, Shaul has moved away from the Ruach Ra. Now he's got this Ruach Elohim. It's wonderful. It's terrific. But David's still going to run away. Okay. We have much to discuss. We are not going to get through it all tonight. But we're going to try our best to cover what we can. David runs away to Shmuel. So we mentioned he's got to find someplace to go. Where's he going to go? He doesn't know where to go. He knows that Hashem wants him to survive. Where should he go? So first he goes to his wife, Shaul's daughter. That doesn't protect him. So he figures, I'll go to Shmuel. He gets to Shmuel and he tells Shmuel everything that Shaul did to him. Why does he tell him everything Shaul did to him? Evidently they're trying to figure out, what should we do now? Okay, now, if you are Shmuel and David comes to you, you've anointed David, you've anointed Shaul, you're the one who's got the inside scoop on everything that's going on, and you are the figurehead. You're not just the figurehead, you are the even though you're not the king, but ultimately you're the one who crowns kings.
The kingmaker.
You're the kingmaker. I was going to say that. You're the kingmaker. I wasn't sure that was appropriate. So you're the king. You're the one. Everybody looks to you. Everybody respects you. Nobody would have any issues with your directives. If you give a directive, everybody's going to listen. So David comes to you. Now you got to protect this man. He's the Mashiach Hashem. He's the anointed one of God. He's the one who's the next king. You know you're the one who anointed him. You know he's got to be protected. So if you're Shmuel, what would you do? How would you protect David? I know what I would do. You know what I would do?
What?
I would put David in the house behind me. Mm-hmm. I would stand at the door, my hands on my hips, and I would stand there waiting for anybody to dare come to my house. And when Shaul sent his men, I would say, you go back and you tell Shaul that if he wants anything, he should come here himself. Okay, so maybe that's not a way to speak to a king. But I would say, I'm Shmuel and I'm telling you, you cannot kill David. End of story. No, but Shaul said this. Sorry. It's wrong. He didn't do anything wrong. Can't take him. I mean, if David ran to Shmuel for amnesty, that means because he felt that Shmuel could protect him. And I think Shmuel could have. Now, it would have been dancing a little bit because of the issue of showing respect for the king. You can't, even Shmuel cannot disrespect the king. But he can certainly, at least diplomatic way, thank you, he could work his way through it. But he doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't do that.
But you're not dealing with a rational man.
Okay.
When Shaul
okay.
had his Ruach Ra, you're not dealing with a rational man at that point, because if he has the Ruach Ra on him, he'll kill Shmuel
Good.
Himself.
Okay.
Shmuel knew.
Okay. So Shmuel knew, because David told him everything, that that's not going to work.
Right.
So now what's the next best step?
Tell everybody that David is the king, and then, you know, everybody anointed him, he's the next king.
Then you end up with a rebellion, you end up with a civil war. Right? We don't want that yet. That's like
killing off Mashiach is worse than a civil war.
True, but if you can have it, if there's an alternative, that right? Yeah.
The way I see this is that Shmuel rejected protecting him physically in this world because he could not protect him physically. There was no way to put him outside Shaul's reach in the physical world. So he protected him by putting him into a different sphere. They all went into a different sphere. They went into a zone of spiritual protection, which is a completely different domain.
Okay.
It's not the domain of putting him in a house or putting him in a cave and putting guards around him.
Okay.
And that's
so that's well said. So they left the physical and went to the spiritual. But let's understand that. The reason why the spiritual realm was a protection wasn't because you can't reach him in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
It's because by entering that realm,
mm-hmm.
by Sheol entering that realm, he necessarily became transformed as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And he is now no longer intent to kill because he's in the spiritual realm. When you're in the spiritual realm, you see clearly. You're no longer influenced by all the things that are going on. All jealousies, all issues, they melt away because you see clearly what's going on. And so by entering that realm, then David is protected because the only way to get to him is to come through that realm. And that means you're going to no longer want to kill him. In theory, had they remained that way forever after, then David would have been protected forever. But it was clear that that was not a long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
That would take care of the problem for now, but it was not a long-term solution. You can't live this way forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's not running the country. That's not building a Beis HaMikdash. That's not what's going on if you enter that realm. So there has to be that this was not meant to be the solution forever, but it was meant to do something similar to Yonatan snapping Sheol out of it at that time. It could be they realized that that's not going to be a permanent fix, but something to take the heat off David. Yeah.
But David has spent years and years running away from
Sheol. Well, not yet.
Oh, that's a long time.
No.
No.
Not that long.
How long?
What?
How long?
It's not going to be more than. It's not going to be more than 2 years, and I think it's less than that.
Right.
The entire
imagine
episode.
Imagine yourself running for 2 years and not having a home and not...
Yeah. But it hasn't happened yet. I mean, this is just starting. He doesn't know how long it's going to go for. Okay.
But why can't... I still don't know why the prophet can't say, hey guys, he's no longer king.
Good. Well, he can't say... He is still king. He is still... Sheol is still king. David is also king. No one knows David is king.
Does he have to die before he's no longer king?
Well, that was the problem. That was the issue. That was the issue we keep bringing up. That on a simple level, the only way for David to become king is for Sheol to die. But that's what we were saying, that through Yonatan being the faithful chavrusa of David, that there can be some way of remaining within the royal circle. We have to stop, but the issues that we still have over here are, what is this Nayos Barama?
Mm-hmm.
What were Shmuel and David doing exactly? Mm-hmm. The answer will astound you.
Oh.
What Shmuel and David were doing when they went to Nayos Barama. And what they did triggered that when Sheol's agents came, they became influenced,
mm-hmm.
and then Sheol himself becomes influenced.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with that. We also have to deal with what do we see from Sheol over here? A very, very important insight into Sheol and the state he was in. We're going to notice something about that. And finally, we need to understand why does this episode, more than anything else, trigger the intense jealousy of Doeg HaAdomi,
mm-hmm.
who we haven't mentioned for a little bit, but the Gemara says this episode, more than anything else, makes Doeg jealous of David. This is going to be it. So these are the things we have to cover, Mitzvah Hashem, next time.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.